Welcome to The Learning Curve with Roger and Virginia. The Learning Curve is about helping kids get good grades in school and succeeding in life. It's for all parents, teachers and students, as all of life is a learning curve and you succeed in life to the extent that you can learn easily. Today's show is about motivating your kids to enjoy reading and actually having them really benefiting from their reading. To get more information on the material we cover in our shows, you can go to howtolearneasily.com, and if you've got any questions, send them to questions@howtolearneasily.com. Today's guest is Jeffrey Flaum. Jeffrey is a 34-year veteran in the New York City educational school system, and he is the author of the book Motivating Teen and Preteen Readers, How Teachers and Parents Can Lead the Way. Now, this is really a wonderful book, and looking into Jeffrey's background before we invited him to speak to you on The Learning Curve with Roger and Virginia, big message is he actually got spectacular results with the kids in his classroom. So welcome, Jeffrey.
Yes, nice to be here. Thanks, Roger.
If people would like to buy your book, where would they go to find your book?
It's on Amazon. They can go to Amazon.com. It's in paperback and a Kindle book. And they can go to the publisher, which is Roman and Littlefield Education. And they're at www.roman.com. And they can purchase it through them.
I see in some of your material, Jeffrey, a horrific statistic. I mean, I knew that the actual product and outcome of the American educational system was producing only 31% of college graduates that could read at the Department of Education standard of competence in reading. But you're mentioning here, and I think you've just revised the figures, 60% of college freshmen are unable to comprehend their textbooks. That's pretty shocking.
It's scary, and I don't understand how that's happening, and that's also part of what goes on in the colleges today. You know, how it's become a major big business, and you know, they take a lot of kids that might not really be college material, or they never really understood reading and reading comprehension in all the way through high school, and I don't know how they fell through the cracks, and it's hard to believe they were accepted, but as
That's
it stands, they were.
Where's that statistic come from, the 60% that you cite?
I can't, you know, I don't have that right here in front of me.
Okay.
It came out of a recent survey that was done, but I can't give you a specific one at this moment.
That's okay, yeah. There's so many statistics floating around at the moment. One sees them in the newspapers and in the educational publications. Shocking. So when you were teaching, what was the comparative statistic that you were, because you were teaching down at 4th, 5th, and 6th grade?
That's correct, yeah.
And how were those kids doing as a comparison?
Well, that's a good question. The reading scores from the work that I've done and the way I developed reading and writing and thinking, the kids did well in terms of the standardized reading tests and math tests. And they felt like, I mean, I have other programs, in a writing program in contemplation called Contemplation Writing,
right,
where it gets them really inside their heads and develops very a presence, you know, in the room.
Yeah.
Something that you guys talk about in your book, which is, you know, attention and focus and concentration. You know, that's the first thing. I want to put them in the room with me. And if I can get their attention, and then they can get their own attention internally, I know that I've set the field so they can learn to read and become aware of what they're doing in the reading process.
Yeah, I notice in your work you speak a lot about creating or developing the desire in the student to want to read, joy reading. Obviously, this comes after they become aware that reading is a useful and important thing to them to do, and then it's very much an enjoyable thing to do. What was your sequence of introducing all of this to the kids?
I don't think you can beat it into their head, and I don't think that you can lead a horse to water, but you can make him drink. It's about intrinsic motivation, and they have to get the idea from inside themselves. The questions in this book, the 1,000 or so questions on reading process and everything else, is designed to make them think and reflect about reading, the process, and their reading lives, and to, for better or for worse, you know, as you point out in your book, to get you to face the blocks, the conflicts that are there, and the misunderstoods, and to get past that, see what set them back maybe in their early reading lives, and so they could get over that and move forward and with a, you know, better attitude and a better head about reading.
How does your book make a difference?
I think that they are talking about rigor, developing a, you know, more rigorous curriculum, and the questions push the kids. I'm not afraid to, you know, I won't deal with watered down curriculums. You have to put in a lot of hard work and a lot of thought into, it's not just a question and answer program where here's the question, now write an answer, but it's about reflecting and visualizing, concentrating and moving back into your past and seeing things. It works on the head internally, and I think that in a lot of, you know, reading is all about an internal life, and I'm trying to give the kids these frameworks to understand the reading process, an inner eye, a mind's eye, an imaginary TV screen in the mind, the inner silent reading voice, and the an inner imaginary ear that listens to all this stuff that's being read. I think a lot of kids don't get that and don't have those frameworks or tools to understand reading, and that's what I'm trying to get across, you know, in the book, and hopefully making a difference. This is not really addressed in depth, you know, in the schools, as far as I'm concerned. And you have to give the kids those tools, and then the teacher falls back in the background a little bit, because now the kids have the tools and the skills, what I call the prerequisite fundamental skills for learning or learning how to learn. And so then they can and then get the internal motivation to read.
That's very interesting. So actually part of what you're giving the kids or introducing to them is in some respects how to use their mind and how to then apply it to the reading process. Is that what I'm getting from?
Yes, absolutely, yes.
That's very brilliant.
In your book, you use the term reading life. Can you please define that?
Everything connected with reading, how you learned how to read, if your parents read to you as a child, read out loud, your experiences in school with reading, all the books that you've read, your attitudes and opinions about reading, and everything, that words, you know, how you deal with words and how you understand and feel about words, and the meaningfulness of reading and how it connects you with your real, quote, life.
You know, I noticed in some of your material you refer to this three-dimensional and holographic image or picture, and you're just speaking there of just how the words affect you. So you're finding that it's very beneficial to the children to introduce them to the notion that words will excite or incite or induce holographic imagery that they can then, you know, deal with?
Yes, yes.
That's interesting. Not many people are aware of that fundamental in the educational process.
This is something, again, I make things up in the classroom. I experiment, and that's what I did. And I think most of the stuff that I have developed is corroborated and validated by the research and education. So reading is like a virtual reality, a three-dimensional holographic virtual reality. And lo and behold, I found now a couple of really brilliant guys. This guy, Dr. Jeff Zaks, he's at Washington University in St. Louis, and he has done studies, MRIs on the brain, when people read, and found that they go through the whatever the motions that come out of the paragraph or movements or actions replicated some in the brain. They've done these MRIs. It's like phenomenal research. This came out in 2009. There are a bunch of, you know, interviews with him on the internet. And also another, this guy is an absolute genius, Dr. David Abram. He talks about reading as magic. That's the thing that's really missing. This guy's done everything. He's a performance artist, everything. And he talks about the alphabet and how you read these little symbols on a page, and you can go back in time, and it creates all this visual imagery, and that's the magic of reading. That's the thing that I don't think is getting across to a lot of kids. That's the spur for the inner or internal or self-motivation to read, to get the kids to see the pictures.
You're very excited about this, I see.
Actually. The excitement was that, you know, I thought I was nuts. In fact, I have a post on that on BAM Street Radio, and the post is reading as a three-dimensional hologram virtual reality. Yeah. And I'm saying, well, either people think you're totally insane or they're thinking, but I mean, when I saw these two, Zach and Abram, and what their research has come up with, so that I wasn't alone.
It sobers you up a little bit. But the other side of the coin is, one must realize that not everybody is three-dimensional holographic like this. A lot of people, their minds work quite differently, and it's not right or wrong or impaired or any silly thing like that. It's just a difference. And it's like some folk are wonderful athletes. Now, your elite athletes are very, very often three-dimensional holographic with extraordinary perception, and your nerdy bookie types tend to be more in their heads. That's okay. Just the picture's probably a little smaller, that's all.
Yeah, Raj, I had once, in all my stuff deals with the imagination and creativity. So once this contemplation writing program that I have, where the kids listen to music and get into their head, and then write a paragraph about what their experience was. One kid said, he was a great kid, and he said, all I see is black.
Yeah.
And that's what goes to what you're saying. Sometimes that, and I said, well, I better be able to, lighten this up a little bit, because that's an issue that not everybody capable of it. And and I'm just talking ideally in terms of this virtual reality.
We're finding something in the order of 25-30% truly holographic. And interestingly enough, it quite often is associated with folk who are mislabeled as dyslexic and quote, learning disabled, when actually, in many respects, it appears to be an indication of a higher level of ability, even spiritual ability. But I notice here you have a lot of questions that parents and teachers are able to use in order to open up and develop and explore these capacities with their children.
I also noticed that you have this thing called a mini lesson. Can you tell us about the parts of the mini lesson?
Yeah, the mini lesson is, the way it works is that the teacher or the parent gives a child or students a question, like early morning work, whatever, or whatever part of the day they can do it, and the kids write an answer to the question. It's either the same day or the next day after the answers have been reviewed. Teacher will have some of the kids read out their responses and ask questions about the responses, probing them more deeply. So why do you read? I read because it's fun. Well, what do you mean by fun? Take and expand their responses as far as they can take it and get the other kids interacting.
Well, it sounds like in order for you to have participation, to have the kids participate and be able to feel comfortable talking about their views, their answers to questions and such, you would have to create a safe space in that classroom.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. No program can be implemented if the teacher is not in control. Well, in terms of reading the responses, for example, When I read responses out loud for my writing program, this contemplation writing, which gets into some pretty, you know, personal and heavy stuff from the kids and a lot of, you know, tough experiences, I read everything anonymously. In terms of this year, I don't want to start like, you know, any hassles, conflicts brought up by, this is Johnny Jones's writing.
Can't do that. That would tend to silence them all down.
Right. But I, you know, in the beginning, it's always breaking the ice, you know, there's hesitancy. But after a while, after a bunch of responses are read, the kids get to loosen up and open up. And that's a key role of the teacher and parent as discussion leader, to get the kids to open up and to come down on them critically.
I can definitely see how a teacher can use this. Can you explain a bit more about how a parent can use this?
Mm-hmm. Basically, the same approach, one-on-one. I think I've read your bio that you've done tutoring involved with that. I've done it. My wife tutors in reading and math. Two-one situation has a lot of advantages, and do have the time, and there is a safe space for the kids to respond. And you, again, you would ask a question, or you having not being in the classroom, not being under the time constraints, you could ask a few, you know, one or two or three questions, and have your child answer the questions, and then let him or her read it out, push them further to get more out of the response and get them to reflect on it some more where the response is not strong enough, let's say, and you get a dialogue going with your child. But, you know, if you have a child that's into rolling their eyes when they say, oh, this question, I know the answer to this, and that's something you bring out too, this the attitude of know-it-all, that's another block. You know, a lot of these questions, Virginia, can be seen as being obvious, but I don't think it's so obvious considering what Roger and I were talking about, the statistics about, you know, reading comprehension on a college level. So
right. Yeah, what you're actually revealing here is the importance of being able to complete things so that the kid comes certain of his knowledge and is able to apply what they're learning, as against what goes on in too many classrooms where kids are introduced to things and the curriculum has to keep them moving forward, and they literally don't accomplish true mastery or competence on too many things.
Right, yes. Times they just get bored out and bummed out. But there is an issue, too, you know, about where kids, you know, say this is boring reading and stuff like that. And I just remember one time we had a drug program where the cops came into the classroom and started off the lesson with, do you find a lot of things boring? Or are you boring, you know, and no openness there, and you're dealing with a lot of closed minds and closed-mindedness, and that's what this one-to-one process between parent and child can do to open up a communication. Key to teaching, you know, the first and foremost, if the teacher can't communicate, no matter how smart she is, it's going to work.
So it sounds a lot like your method is, or what you have in your book, is that you, a teacher or a parent, would choose a question and give it to their child, and the child might write down a real quick answer, something very surface, but on looking at it, what the parent or the teacher's job to do is to draw out more, to have the child look deeper, look a little further, not just take the first answer that comes along, but what's really behind all of it.
Right, yes. Both ways. At the same time that the parent is drawing out and probing further into the response, you're teaching, you're giving those skills of reflection and visualization and concentration. That's part of this process, that the kids, you know, don't snap up the first thing that comes to their mind, but dig deeper and more expansively to come up with a more in-depth answer, and that hopefully will change as you go from day one to you know, from question one to question 100, that they're coming up with more detailed responses
and more complete answers.
Yes,
more truthful answers.
Yes.
It actually sounds like what you're teaching is problem-solving skills, because too many times people will go with the first answer they come up with rather than reflecting, well, is there a different way or a better way?
Part of the process that I'm teaching is to drop them into the middle of their creativity or imagination of their mind, and them scout, you know, and see what's there. That moment of tension, oh, I don't got an answer, I don't have an answer, what should I do, you know, that they relax, which is a big part of this too, is to see the reading process as a calmer, relaxing process, as opposed to the test mania that's turning kids off to reading and getting them developing test anxiety and reading anxiety.
That's an interesting point you're making there. Everything is so superficial and fast in terms of multiple choice questions and just plugging in an answer without any contemplation and without any real recourse on the student's part to their actual knowledge, if they've got it. And that's a tragic situation we've brought out.
Yeah, Roger, it's purely functional to go a high score on the reading test. That's it. The meaning has kind of fallen off the table there, and that's the key to motivation.
You state in your book that motivating teen and preteen readers looks at different levels of thinking. Is this what you've just been telling us about, the different levels of thinking?
You know, some of the terms that come up in education, the jargon, you know, are good, but they're usually, you know, beaten to death. And then, you know, the good part of that phrase or word, you know, is lost. But one of the words is metacognition, thinking about thinking.
Gee, that'll turn me off instantly. What are we talking
about?
Yeah,
I know. I need a definition on that.
When a kid writes an answer, I would ask them, well, how did you come to your answer? What thinking processes did you use to figure out your response? Analysis, synthesis, visualization, and you know, and as boring and tedious as that can sound, you know, oh, who's going to want to deal with kids? Metacognition, thinking about thinking. The kids enjoyed listening to other kids describe their thinking processes. Mm. You know, and you know, guys, some of the processes that were described, we were on the floor laughing. But you know, you talk about your book, Learning Styles, and there's a million ways there to come to responses, and it was pretty interesting listening to what the kids have to say.
We've heard about how you put together a mini lesson and how parents can use it and how teachers can use this. I'm curious if you could tell us some of the success stories you've had. So in other words, what was the problem or situation? How did you apply your principles that you have in your book? And what were the results?
The Reluctant Reader, Michael, that's the chapter. Michael, the Reluctant Reader. Names were changed to protect the innocent or the guilty. one father that came in, Michael's father came in. He said, Mr. Flom, I buy Michael millions of books. His room is inundated with books and bookcases, and he never picks up a book to read. And that's a common approach. I mean, a lot of kids don't have access to books to begin with. But in this example with Michael, I'm giving him all sorts of questions, like kind of catered to Michael on words, word activities, him into words, to get him, again, go back to a lot of things that you talk about, the blocks in reading, early reading experiences, get him into rating. There are questions on rating, the reading process, on a scale from 0 to 10. Good are you? How much energy do you put in reading? And he could put 10 being the highest, 0 being the lowest. If he puts 0, fine, you know, because I want him, you know, face that conflict and not just kind of being this murky thinking that goes on his mind. I don't like to read and I don't want to pick up a book, but I want him to look it straight in the eye and deal with it and solve the problem, because he has to get over that. So, you know, so I'm going to, you know, I'll give him questions on his reading process, you know, and what goes on in his head when he reads. Is he distracted? You know, when he reads, how focused is he on the words in front of him? What pictures is he seeing? It could be done in 100 questions over the course of a year. That could be done with a one-to-one situation with a parent and child. But, the question that comes up is, I don't see questions, creating this world of inner motivation and virtual realities. I don't agree, because I've been, dealing with questions, asking questions of my kids for years. When they see that there's concern, enthusiasm on part of the teacher, they will respond, and they do get, off on listening to their classmates' responses. So get the kid to open up.
That's good guidance for our parents listening to us today, Jeffrey. And that's also a wonderful point to end off on today's half an hour with Roger and Virginia on the Learning Curve.
Thanks, Roger. Thanks, Virginia. Thanks for having me and giving me a voice to discuss the book. Thank you.
Well, it's an important subject, and we're delighted to to be able to bring such value as you are making available to parents. And next week we'll have the return of Jeffrey to discuss some of the actual drills and questions that you can use with your child to help them really get into learning and have them really appreciating the skill of reading and how best to apply their attention and minds to the subject of reading. You've been listening to Roger and Virginia at the Learning Curve, so tune in next week to get the second part of Jeffrey Plaum. He's the author of the book, Motivating Teen and Preteen Readers, How Teachers and Parents Can Lead the Way to Better Use of the Reading Materials Presented to Them. Any questions you've got regarding our shows, send them to questions@howtolearneasily.com.